Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to another episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. Today's guests, there are more than one for a start. There are actually three guests. A couple of weeks ago, they shared a post to Instagram entitled "To the Dope White Mum." With everything going on right now, it was interesting to have something focused on someone like me. And what that post did was really highlight a mother's role in everything that's going on right now and how we can have a massive impact on the generations to come, namely our children. I then went on a massive rabbit hole and I was going through all the Instagram feed. I was then listening to the podcast. And here we are, three of the five women that are the Dope Black Mums. Hi! How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
I'm very good. I know we don't get to see each other that often. We're like, hey.
We should say actually who we've got. So we've got Endy McKay, we've got Karina White and Natalie Duvall. Hello.
Thank you for having us.
No, at all. Do we think the best thing maybe, because there are so many voices today, is everyone to go round, say your name, like we're on a quiz show, tell us a little bit about yourself. So, Endy, should we start with you?
Yes. My name's Endy, which is like Wendy without the W. I always like to say that nice and clear. And I'm one-fifth of the Dope Black Mum. I'm an actor. I'm a writer. I teach as well. I teach acting. And I have one son who is nine. So I'm delighted to be here today and thanks for having us.
Ah, thank you. Karina, you're next.
Right, so I am also one-fifth of the Dope Black Mums podcast. I am a branding and sports marketing specialist. I sit on the board of an organisation called BCOMS, which is the Black Collective of Media and Sport. I'm a school governor. I have loads of other projects that I do. I don't know how I manage them all and balance them all. But yeah, I have one daughter who is 10 going on 25. And yeah, that's me.
Amazing. Natalie?
Hi, I'm Natalie. I also trained as an actress. I went to the Brit School of Performing Arts, and studied at East 15 as well. I have a degree in drama and English and a master's actually. But like all actors, you always have to have that side hustle. So I'm also a marketing manager for one of the biggest energy drinks in the world. I won't say the name, but they're very big and you'll know them because they give you wings. And I also have my own business. So I created Christmas decorations of colour at Christmas time, just so that on the Christmas tree, we could have fairies that were brown, just because I couldn't find any fairies that were brown when I was looking. I have two daughters, Sophia and Olivia. They are 6 and 9. I'm a single mama. I'm the only single mama in our Dope Black Mums little five that we have. And with all that, I'm also the party planner, the cook, the hairdresser, the PA, the taxi. The bank, the cleaner, the organiser, the accountant, the stylist.
Natalie, you're making me feel tired.
I'm exhausted. So yeah, just, you know, we're super women, all of us. So it's just, yeah, it's a lot, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
So how did you all come together in the first place?
It's a bit of a weird one. So there is another podcast collective called Dope Black Dads. Marvin Harrison that founded Dope Black Dads, his wife Nina Harrison founded Dope Black Mums. And essentially we were all in a WhatsApp group together. So we have a safe space, which is the WhatsApp group. We've got two of them. And Nina basically said, who's free to record a podcast on X day? And we were like, Natalie and I were like, we're free. And the Nadja was like, I'm free. And then Natalie and Endy are best friends. So Natalie was like, yep, my friend will be free as well. And
I just dragged her along.
Yeah, Endy's the worst. You'll get to know. Endy is the worst one when it comes to checking her phone. So by the time she would have seen that message, it would have been about 5 days later. So Natalie was like, Endy will be free. It's fine. And then we came together and recorded that first podcast. And considering we were four, five women who've never done a podcast together, didn't know each other really.
You didn't even know each other, because I've listened to that first episode and you wouldn't think that to be the case at all.
Only Natalie and Endy knew each other previously. None of the rest of us, we'd never kind of met in person or interacted. It was like the first time was recording that episode, and then a year later, here we are.
I think that was what was really nice as well, because we didn't know each other in a way, and because we are so different, we all had, obviously there was a commonality in our experiences being Black mothers, but also we had such different life experiences that we kind of realised we didn't often agree on anything, which
we still don't.
But isn't that important as well? You know, because you should all have different opinions. It's that thing of you might be Black, that one thing you've got in common, but actually you're still five very different individuals who are going to have, you know, and it's really interesting whenever you're talking about subjects, hearing all of your different points of view. And then hearing how some of you might go, actually, I did think that at first, but now that I've heard that, maybe I'll change my mind. And I think that's really interesting.
We always call ourselves the Spice Girls of Dope Black Mums. Like, there's one for everyone, basically, whether you are, you know, very religious. Nanadua, Christianity is her core. That's where she comes from. Whether you're a vegetarian, vegan, whatever you are these days, ND, I don't know.
These days, I've been a vegetarian my whole life. I've never eaten meat these days.
But have you upgraded to vegan? That's what we want to know.
Yes, I've kind of, that's what she's talking about. I'm kind of transitioning to veganhood, But also though, Natalie, it's really important, I think, that because we are Black women, and often in the media, you don't get that full, holistic, rounded view. Often it's kind of like the angry Black woman or the single mother. And what was so fascinating about our WhatsApp group is we had women on there that were doing their own, you know, sustainable living, growing their own vegetables, through to women who are lawyers, through to women who are, you know, just such a plethora of women. And we were like, actually, that's important. And we need
How many women were on the WhatsApp group?
So when we started, I'd probably say there was maybe about 60, would you say, Natalie?
Yeah, about 60.
As of today, because I did check today, we've now got two WhatsApp groups, and across both of them, there is about 315 women across both
of them. Is it just lighting up all day long?
My goodness.
So Endy's like nodding her head. She doesn't even check her WhatsApp. So
I don't know
if Endy knows what's going on in the group. It's literally just like message after message. But what is so lovely about it is that over the last year, these women have grown together with people that a lot of them had never met before, didn't know, live in different parts of the UK. We've supported women through their divorces. We've supported women through baby loss. We've supported women through new relationships, through homelessness and, you know, finding their feet again or finding themselves again. And I think that's what I really love about the groups is that a lot of these women never knew each other before. They would never be friends with other mums like that because they're so different. But actually, they come together. We do brunches every month. We did a live show last year that sold out in like 24 hours. We had to release more tickets. And these women, I would probably say 30-40% of the chat is about parenting. And the rest is about motherhood and womanhood and everything that accompanies that. Yeah, and sisterhood. So I think for a lot of people, it's been a lifeline and it's been a way to connect people globally via technology.
I think spaces like that are so important. And you know, it's why I even created this podcast, because when you're looking at other narratives and feeling like, why don't I fit into that narrative? Why do I feel like I'm failing? In my case, it was, why don't I feel like motherhood is wonderful? Why aren't I taking it like a duck to a water? And actually, when you find yourself with a group of people who talk honestly and on your level, suddenly your confidence grows. And that's obviously what you're doing for every single woman, every single mum that is part of that WhatsApp, because they know they're not on their own. They're so supported and they can come at you with anything because the judgment is taken out of it.
Yeah, the judgment's taken out of it. And also there's a commonality between us all. Like we said, we're all black. And so just having that space, because there isn't really a space like that. You know, when I had my children, I went on to the normal sites like, you know, NetMums, MumsNet. You know, there's some amazing sites out there that are really supportive. But I felt very lost on those sites. And a lot of my issues, a lot of my experiences was not shared with the rest of the people on those sites. And I was lucky that I had girlfriends and I had a good sisterhood around me in order for me to talk. But a lot of women don't have that. And that's what this space creates.
Yeah. What were your own childhoods like?
Wow.
Where do you start?
Wow, I love that. Giovanna just goes straight in.
Do you know what? I'm going to tell Endy to go first because I think...
Think of your answer.
No, I've got a really interesting childhood, but I think for Endy, mm-hmm. reading... So Endy did a blog last week and she's released part two today and it's entitled Being the Only Black in the Village because she's mixed heritage. So I think your childhood's actually really interesting, Endy, and it's something that I resonate with but don't fully resonate with because I'm not mixed.
I grew up in out of London. My parents moved from South London to a place called Forest Row, really lovely bohemian kind of little village about an hour away from London, and yes, that I did experience quite a lot of racism, and it's something that I don't think about. I left that village when I was 16 and it kind of feels like another life. But it was a melody to my childhood in a way, particularly, well, teenage years, it kind of accelerated. But I had loads of wonderful things about my childhood, but it was just me with my blonde hair, blue-eyed mum living in this village. And I didn't actually know anyone who looked like me, which was quite challenging. And then obviously faced with the kind of some micro kind of aggressions, but some quite overt sort of racist experiences. It was quite hard to negotiate. And actually where we are now in this movement, Black Lives Matter movement, and what's going on politically in today's kind of landscape definitely has made a lot of people kind of speak up and talk about experiences that they buried quite sort of far down. Yes, so I live obviously in South London, so I have a very diverse life now, and I know people from all kind of walks of life, all ethnicities, and my son does, and that's really important to me. But it also brings home the importance, if you do live in areas where there aren't many brown faces, it can feel like, oh, this is not relevant to me. And I think it absolutely is, and actually probably we have to do more work in those spaces to make sure we move on from the kinds of experiences I had. Yeah.
And did you all think about becoming mums and having families of your own? Was that something you thought of? At what point did you think that might happen?
I definitely did. Endy was one of the first people in our group of friends to have her baby. And my baby is 9 months older than, younger than her baby. So literally,
I literally saw him and was like, I've got one, I've got an idiot.
I held Miles in my hand and I was like, this is it, I want one. And literally, so she started it and gave me the confidence to be like, yeah, let's do this. Because I think sometimes whatever age you are, I was 27 when I had my first child, or going on 28. And whatever age you are, it's still kind of like, oh my goodness, I'm pregnant. And I think I was fearing telling my mum I was pregnant because that meant she would know that I've had sex. And it's like, and even though I've been living with my partner for like 3 years, we'd been together for 5, like I still didn't want her to think of me having sex. So
you know what, I felt like that third time round because I had 2 and I was like, you know, we're gonna leave a massive gap, and then it just surprise. So I felt really weird telling them, you know, because then you have to go, yeah, we had sex and we didn't use and it was not planned, you know. Then they kind of like, you know, it's really weird then.
It's
sorry,
awkward.
Mom and Dad.
It's that's awkward. How I felt as well. I was like, I didn't want to tell my dad that I was pregnant because I was like, now my dad's gonna know that I'm having sex. And I was like 25, and even like now, I'm like, it's weird. My dad knows that I have sex, like, yeah, sort of thing. So, it, yeah, I totally feel you with that one. Totally feel you with that one.
I was 27, yeah, when I had my son. And it was like, I'd been with his dad for 5 months. I was in the process of buying my first property, and I was filming the Channel 4 show, and it was like literally completely unplanned, but also on some kind of weird subconscious level, I'd never been pregnant before. I kind of let it happen. So I say it was unplanned on a logical level, but you know, I was kind of completely in love, and who knows? So it was terrifying. I remember my mum being like, that's it, you know, your life's over, that'll be the end of any fun. And I was in some sense so fearful that my life was going to be over and it was going to be awful, that when I had him, I just was so unprepared for this love that I felt, and how amazing and fun and awe-inspiring the whole thing was. So in a way, being so terrified kind of served me well. I think sometimes when women are like, oh, it's going to be amazing and perfect and wonderful, then it can be, you know, the disappointment comes. Whereas I think because I just was so like, oh my goodness, what's going to happen?
Well, there's that massive pressure, isn't there? There's that, not pressure, there's that build-up of the moment where you meet your baby, where you're meant to look at them with such love and just be hit with, you know, just this rush, where actually a lot of people look down and are like, oh God, this is so overwhelming. What is this?
Who are you?
And it's hard to admit. And it's hard to admit because you've spent 9 months going, oh, I love you, baby, I love you. And then this massive thing happens. You push them out. That's strange. And then they're on you and it just feels so bizarre.
It's also quite weird for me. I'm quite a dark complexion and my children's father is slightly lighter than me. But with my second daughter, she came out and she was white. And that threw me completely. And I was just like, so where's my child? Who, like, I felt like it was an EastEnder plot where someone had come and taken my child, swapped it with the white one and tried to pass it off as mine. Cause I was like, whose child is this? And please, can I have my one returned? Cause she just looked completely white. She's found her color now. And she's still very light skinned. And I just didn't recognize her. Cause my oldest child came out and she was very dark. She was basically my complexion. And so I instantly recognized her as my child. And so I felt a bit detached from that whole situation because I just didn't recognise who this child was.
Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely that thing. And I think maybe with the second as well, because you already feel like you know what your child looks like, what your child will look like. It's that weird thing. How long did it take for that to kind of ease up and that bond to form?
It took a couple months because also she just cried the whole time. She didn't stop crying. I think when she started talking, I remember Andy saying, God, I forget that she can talk because she just cries all the time. Like it's so weird to hear her actually talk. And like, when I say she cried all the time, like we took her to the craniologist because I thought maybe something's wrong with her head. Maybe she's had a hernia. Maybe she's trying to tell us something because she just did not stop crying. Oh. And like all things with babies, usually like with colic and everything, they just grow out of it. And that was the answer. She literally just grew out of it. And she's a lovely, happy, sassy diva girl, but she's full of life now. But yeah, that first 3 months was the hardest I've ever experienced because she just would not stop crying.
And it's so hard when it is hard, when it's hard like that and they're crying, it's hard to feel the love because you get the mum sweats as soon as, you know, any sound is made. Yeah. Going out and about in public is really hard. Yeah. I don't know if you fed, but breastfeeding was difficult even thinking about because then the mum sweats, you're slippy. It's just not nice anymore. Yeah. You know, all of that. It's just, and people are looking at you as if you're meant to know what you're doing because you're the mum. We're all just making it up. And sometimes I used to feel like any stranger, do you know what to do with this baby?
There's a lot of pressure, you're right, to just be like, oh, you know, some kind of Disney moment. And it's not always like that.
I think it's tough because I absolutely hated my pregnancy with a passion. I hated it. I hate everything about
being
pregnant.
What didn't you like about it?
I had morning sickness from, I think, month 2 of being pregnant right up until I gave birth. It was awful. Like I was in and out of hospital because I couldn't keep. So the first, I'd probably say the first trimester and a half, I couldn't keep anything down. So anything I ate, I would just vomit it back up again. So then I had to go into hospital to be put on a drip because I wasn't eating. I wasn't keeping anything down. And then halfway through the second trimester, it switched to that as soon as I was hungry, I would start feeling sick and would start vomiting. So as soon as I'd wake up in the morning, I'd run to the toilet and just start vomiting. And obviously your stomach's empty. So then I'd eat something. And then once that settled, I'd start feeling sick again. And then if it got to the point where like my stomach was completely empty, I would physically start like vomiting and everything. And that was literally for the whole seven, eight months of my pregnancy. Absolutely hated it. But then I guess the bonus came that when I had my daughter, I was only in labour for about 5 hours, maybe four and a half, 5 hours. I didn't even have time.
Hate women like you.
No, honestly, it was ridiculous. We're at home and I rang the hospital and I was like, yeah, I think I'm in labour, blah, blah. And they were like, yeah, because it's your first child, you know, you can come in, but we'll probably send you home again, blah, blah, blah. So my daughter's dad was like, well, if I take you down to the hospital and, you know, they're bringing you back home, I'm not taking you back down there again. I was like, what do you mean? Like,
charming.
What do you mean?
You can walk.
Yeah, I was like, what do you mean? So I remember like saying, okay, fine. So I went and sat in the bath and literally like I could feel the contractions coming whilst I sat in the bath. He's sitting playing Call of Duty on the PlayStation, like with his mates, with his little headset on. I can hear him saying, oh yeah, like don't know how long I'll be able to play for because, you know, I think Karina's in labour, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, we got to the hospital and we went to the A&E department for women, and whilst he went and parked the car, so I went in and I said to the lady, so they've told me to come here just to be checked, but I think, you know, you're probably going to send me home. And she went, darling, you were in labor, you need to go to the labor ward. She said literally she could just look and see. So they took me through like these like theater rooms, like a back way to get to the labor ward. Got there, they put me in like a broom cupboard, like a really, really small room. Checked me over and they were like, right, you're 4 centimetres dilated. You need to go and do a urine sample and whatever. So I was like, fine. The time it took me to go and do the urine sample and come back, I was like, guys, I need to push. I feel like I need to do a poo. Like, I need to push. They were like, no, no, no. I'm like, seriously, I can feel something in my bum. I want to push. So I literally went from like 4 centimetres dilated to fully dilated in the space of like 10 minutes. So they had to take me out of the broom cupboard and put me in like a proper room. And as we were walking through like the doctor's station, like a contraction came and I was like, and then afterwards the doctor was like, yeah, we thought you were going to give birth in the middle of the hallway.
five hours, Karina.
Well, I would probably say that's 5 hours from being like at home. Matt, I'm really sorry to break this to you. By the time I got to the hospital, it was so quick. My sister came with like water, charger, like bags, you know, like everything getting ready for like the long haul to be my birthing partner. She walked in the room and I was holding my daughter.
She must have been gutted.
She was so upset. And then like I was meant to be her birthing partner when she had my niece and nephew. And when she had my nephew, it was just so complicated. I think at one point they thought she wasn't going to make it through. So they wouldn't let anyone into the room apart from her partner. And then the second time when she had my niece, similar, it was just she was really struggling. Her heart rate kept dropping every time she had a contraction, so they wouldn't let me in the room for that either. So I was like, I was here, but they just, yeah, they wouldn't
you're just not
in.
Destined to be going through that together.
It's just not destined at all. But you know, it's I think where my labour was so straightforward, didn't have any pain relief, nothing. The most I had was stitches afterwards. Seeing my sister's experience really hit it home for me, just how dangerous labour can be. And I know after she had my nephew, I remember they let us in the room to see her, and I was talking to her and she was really out of breath and she's like talking to me. She's like... And the doctor came in and he was like, oh, I'm just going to check you over. And he was like, oh, you're really breathless. How long have you been breathless? And she was like, oh, like, we're really laid back. So she tried to play it off and she was like, oh, only like 5 minutes, I think, just because I got up to go to the toilet. And I was like, no, she's been breathless since I've been in here, which is about 20, 25 minutes. So then he asked her, like, how many times has she changed her pad and how often? And I could just see his face drop. And he basically said, right, we need to get you into theatre, because she was bleeding internally. So I really felt for my brother-in-law, because it was like, do you stay with your newborn baby or do you go with, like, your partner? And I was like, it's fine. I was like, Andy, it's fine. Go with Charlene. I've got Alfie. It's not a problem. Like, I can see. He was like, are you sure? I was like, it's fine. And yeah, basically they said that if they hadn't caught it, she probably would have died. She literally was bleeding out, and just of the complications. And, you know, my nephew was born with forceps, and it was just so traumatic. And looking back, I'm like, that really hit home for me, just how dangerous childbirth actually can be for a woman.
And we've seen in the last couple of years as well, the statistics around Black women, which is even harder. And I was speaking to someone the other day, actually, about how difficult it is having that statistic put on you. Suddenly, like, so when you're now in that situation, there's that other worry of just that this is a life and death situation. I imagine for your sister, obviously she's not with us now to talk about it, it must play on your mind after you've been in that situation and then you hear statistics like that. The reality of that.
Yeah, I think it's tough because knowing that, and, you know, we've spoken about this a lot amongst ourselves about the statistics and what could be the reasons for that. And we've lent our voice to a documentary that looks into it. And I think it's so difficult because not only are we 5 times more likely as Black women to die during childbirth, we are also more at risk for our children to be stillborn or to be born prematurely. So you couple that with everything, and then it actually really starts to hit home for you just how disadvantaged we are as Black women and as mothers if we choose to have a baby. It's like Russian roulette. You don't know if you're going to come out the other end of the 9 months alive, or whether your baby's going to be alive, or whether your baby's going to be born prematurely.
I think, because, well, we all know, as, sorry, Andy, you go.
No, I was just going to say, I think one thing that's really positive that's coming out of this dialogue that we're kind of all having at the moment is getting people to embrace the term anti-racist, and to kind of interrogate not just racism out in the society, but also within ourselves, you know, any unconscious bias we have. I know there was a study that looked into this very thing around women in childbirth, Black women in childbirth. And they found that often it could often be sometimes Black or women of colour who are, or men of colour who are midwives, who also are still susceptible to unconscious bias, that will think, oh, if they've got to look after two women, will they go perhaps take more care of Mrs. Jones, who's there, a white middle-class lady with her partner, who's maybe more likely to complain or assert herself than, you know, a lady here who's of ethnic background or whatever. And so it really hit home to me, that study, how it isn't kind of a black and white issue. It's very much around these preconceived ideas we have of how Black women can handle pain. Sometimes race and class come hand in hand, how assertive certain people can be from different demographics compared to others. They all play into, I think, you know, what can happen when a woman and another midwife is in that situation, because it's not obviously intentional. I don't think any midwife goes into work thinking, I want to not look after any particular demographic. It's much more subtle, these nuances, but they do need unpacking. And I think that's one positive that's come from this dialogue at the moment.
Yeah, because it's one thing to have the statistic, but now it's breaking it down to ensure that it's...
Yeah. Why are these things happening? And I think it's multi-layered, obviously, but definitely one thing is this unconscious bias that you know, we're all susceptible to. I keep saying it's not something that only affects white people. You know, Black people can have the same thing. We can listen to a certain voice with a certain accent, and that makes us think authority, this, that. You know, we all are living in the same society that perpetuates some of these ideals. And so I think, yeah, we can all do work to unpack that, however uncomfortable it is.
And it is, I think it's sitting in that discomfort, isn't it? And working through it, because unless we do, nothing changes. And I think that's across the board. Everyone is feeling this discomfort because, you know, you have your safe space where you've been talking about issues like this for years, whereas everyone else is kind of like, oh, I didn't even know I was, I'm not racist, I didn't know this was a thing, but hold on, there's all these things that I'm a part of this system, and it's unpicking it and feeling uncomfortable and having those conversations with people. And you know, even with, it's very difficult as well, I think, because everyone's telling you different things. And actually, Natalie, I think you said in one podcast, I think it was you, you said, oh, I've written it down somewhere, something like, I'm not an expert, I'm just black.
Yeah,
and I think that, hit the nail on the head. Yeah, yeah, it's so it's interesting. So I know that some people are like, oh, you shouldn't talk to your black or brown friends about different things. But actually, it's unlocked so many conversations that are really fundamental in friendships as well. And all these different experiences and stuff. So as much as it's difficult to have conversations, I think find the people that are comfortable having conversations with you, or comfortable to be uncomfortable with you, and go for it as well. Because I think that's the only way that we're ever going to be able to change stuff. Back onto pregnancies and labour. Natalie, you've done it twice and you didn't like the fact that Karina's done it in 5 hours. So come on.
I find that just really disrespectful that she did it in five hours.
I'm so sorry about that, Natalie.
No. Yes,
but that was... You know, take my womb next time. It's fine.
Literally, no. My first time was 36 hours. So it was like... It was horrendous. And the second time was quicker. The second time was maybe about seven, eight hours. But it ended really badly with me hemorrhaging and bleeding out and not great. My children's father, he said that when he saw me, it looked like someone had opened a bottle of Coke and just poured it between my legs, because literally I was just, blood was, he thought, that's it then. I'm going to be a single dad, because how can she live without all that blood inside her? He was so confused. But it was a lack of iron, and all my blood wasn't clotting, and so when the baby came out, basically all the blood that was behind the baby just came out with it. So the second time wasn't the greatest. The first time was 36 hours. I've had one with an epidural, one without an epidural. I will always go for the epidural if I ever do it again. Like, I'm not a martyr. I will take the drugs, I'll take them all.
You don't get an extra medal.
Yeah, exactly. I'll take it all. I don't mind. So I can't relate. No.
Sorry,
you know,
no. I can't relate. I'm sorry.
Andy did it in a pool with no gas and air even. You just did
but
it in
I
a
didn't
pool.
Have that. You yeah. know what, Andy? High five to you. Team
high
no
five,
drugs.
Karina.
High five.
I mean, I did want the gas and air, but the woman... So I had a home birth, and we were living on the fifth floor with no lift. So it was... And I was, why not? I like a challenge.
Did you have a pool up there as well?
Yeah, so we hired a pool, but my...
Were you not
my,
worried? It's they're heavy that they'd fall
well,
through.
Yes. I left it. Even the midwife said, look, the pool is the dad's. That's, leave that to him, which was a concern because he's like very, very laid back. And I remember being like, oh, you know, I think we should probably check the pool and like unpack it. And he was like, oh, it's fine. So literally while I was then starting labour, he then had to go and sort the pool out, which he hadn't even opened from the package that was outside the door.
Oh, no.
So I was just on my own, obviously, with the whole of it. And he was sorting all the pool out. And then it got to a stage where he was like, OK, we need to call the midwife. And because he was supposed to be helping me count the contractions. And of course, doing that in a pool went out the window. So let's call the midwife. And we called the midwife, didn't come, called again, didn't come, called a third time. And the midwife came, but basically apparently the other midwife had, her car had broken down. I don't know. Again, you kind of question back and think, oh, what was going on there? But anyway, eventually one midwife arrived. She was an amazing woman. And she just said to me, she got me out of the pool, and no waters had broken. And I still wasn't sure. You know, you see it on the films, the water breaks, it's like the beginning of labour. I hadn't had a show, I hadn't had the waters breaking. So I kind of thought, is this actually labour? Maybe she'll come and just be like, it's Braxton Hicks, and I'll feel like so embarrassed. And she came and she was like, okay, no, you're 8 centimetres. So you're nearly ready to go. And I was like, oh yeah, where's the gas and air? Because I was excited that she could bring that, you know. And she was like, oh, I'm afraid because of what's happened, I've got to break it to you. We're just going to have this baby. And I was like, you know. And so I just got back in the, I really like being in the water. I got back in the water. And yeah, 2 hours later, he arrived. So it was actually, I mean, I do remember there was a big mirror in the lounge where we had this massive mirror.
Oh no, and you don't want to see a mirror. I mean, you don't want to see yourself doing it.
Also, I put like, I made my partner, I was like, we have to get these blinds sorted because the blind spray, I was like, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. I had cam doors. Of course, while it was all happening, that went out the window. I wouldn't have cared if like Arsenal Stadium had been looking over me. Do you know what I mean? I was literally, and I just remember looking up into the mirror and I looked like a cow. I looked like an animal. You know that, you know the face you, when you see your children do a poo, they just go in, inward, the inward poo face. I had the inward poo face. And I just, they were talking and they were playing music and it was all really chilled out. But I was just in this poo
face. I love the
face.
Fact that now, almost 10 years later, that is what you take from your birth. You always see that face, yeah, when you think of yourself in labour.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Andy, can we just go back to the fact that he was just, why is it that dads, some dads, are just so laid back? My one was playing Call of Duty on the PlayStation. Yours is just like, yeah, you know, I'll do the pool as and when, you know.
I know, but then I guess I think I'd prefer that than a panicky dad. Like, I remember we went to an antenatal class. And I remember one time the lady was going through everything. And all of a sudden, he was an older man, older bald dad. He just keeled over. And we said, oh, my gosh, is he OK? Like, what's happened? Thinking maybe he's epileptic. And the woman said, oh, no, he just, if you mention blood, he just can't, he faints. And he fainted. And I did think, oh, my God, like, I think I'd rather the chilled out dad than someone. If they were panicky, that would make me. And yeah. I mean, I don't blame them. It must be panicky to see your partner go through that. But I think, yeah, the chilled out thing kind of helped me in that area.
Well, you've got to see what they see, which is quite strange.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of your mirror, you've seen it.
Well, no.
You've seen what our partners have taken away with them.
No, I was looking, when I was saying the cow, I should have clarified it was my face. It was my face I was talking about, Giovanna, not the other end. That probably looked quite cow-like as well. But they did say to me, do you want a mirror? I don't know if you all had this. They said, do you want a mirror to have a look? Because we can see the head. And I was like,
yeah.
And actually I said, no, I couldn't cope with it. It was bad enough just seeing myself like full frontal. I didn't actually see his head come out. And actually his waters didn't break until he was born. And he just came out in one go. So it was quite unusual. I expected to have that thing where the head comes out. You know, you see it on one born every minute, the kind of alien head. I was scared to see that, but it didn't happen. It just came out. So I didn't see that. It must be very hard for the partners to have that view, that image in their mind.
I've been a birthing partner before, though. And I must say, I was an actual birthing partner for one of my friends. And it was probably one of the most amazing experiences. Yeah. Like, it really, really was. But she was meant to be in the pool. She kept going in the pool. And she was like, I don't want to do it because she felt like it was slowing down her labour. So then ended up being on the ball, being on the floor. And she was in labour, I think, she'd been in early labour from during the day, and she only lived just around the corner from King's College, so it wasn't far for us to get there. So we'd been for walks and stuff and trying to, like, speed it up. And I remember when we actually got to the hospital, she was in active labour but wasn't dilating. And then everything just stopped, like, completely stopped. And the midwife went, it's coming. It's her body's way of, because she's been like having contractions non-stop for like 6 hours. She said it's her body's way of preparing her for the final like big push. And I was like, really? So literally her body stopped contracting for about 10-15 minutes. So she laid on the floor and literally it was like she was recharging for 15 minutes.
So
and
clever.
Then, yeah. And then
isn't it amazing? The body.
Bam.
Amazing.
It came and it was time for her to push, and we were there and we were like, push. And her daughter was born to my girl, talking about, to that playing. And to this day, I look at her and like, her daughter's like 4 now. And when she's like being cheeky, I'm like, look, right, I was there for your birth. Yeah, I cut your umbilical cord, right? So pipe down. Yeah, put some respect on my name. But yeah, that was like, it was true. It was so interesting seeing it from the other perspective and, you know, seeing what essentially I went through.
I just think if I was a midwife, I would cry every single day, every single delivery.
Oh, 100%. I actually thought after I had my son, I was like, oh, I'd love to be a midwife. I mean, obviously, I'd be terrible. I've never known anything about anything like that. But in that moment, the rush of endorphins and oxytocin, I was like, yes, I still think what an amazing job to do, to be there to facilitate life coming into this world.
Yeah. And I'd let you deliver my baby.
I mean, well, thank you, Karina. Thank you. I take that. That's really a compliment. But I do think though that to see people in the most vulnerable as well, and you're most kind of, you know, you're just there. I really loved that about having a baby and being pregnant and early motherhood. It always reminded me a little bit of snow days. You know, where it snows in the UK and everything stops, like even work, schedules, it all goes out the window. And it felt like that. There's something kind of wonderfully affirming about being reminded of how non-in control we are, you know. And yeah. I just found it, yeah, I thought what amazing.
You mean like
job.
COVID? Similar which to is like what's happening now.
Which is what she's been enjoying the most.
Yes.
She's been enjoying COVID enjoyed, like no one's business.
I say that.
I've been loving it. She still doesn't answer her phone though, so she uses the excuse now, guys, I'm just teaching all the time online. Like I'm teaching online. I'm teaching online. Okay, MD.
Well, no comment.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
So I liken the first few weeks or a couple of months of motherhood to hell because I really struggled. I struggled with breastfeeding. And I think because of that, it had a knock-on effect to everything else. Buzz was a crier, the same, you know. Yeah. And it was that thing of there was this constant adrenaline, I guess, and you're exhausted, but that keeps going. And I found that at some point that did calm down. But I think feeling like that and feeling like everyone else was on the narrative where it's the most amazing thing and having those snow days, so it can make you feel like, I'm the most maternal person, but not to my own kid. I've made a mistake. Can I send him back? You know, which is really scary to even vocalise, especially at that time. How did you feel, Natalie, when you brought your first daughter home? How did you feel? How were those first few weeks?
So after my 36 hours of hell, literally, because I did bounce back really quickly. And so I was out of the hospital that very same day. And the next day I was at the hairdresser's with the baby getting my hair done. And that was a very important thing for me just because I needed to feel slightly normal just because I had this huge beard that had grown throughout the pregnancy. I, you know, hadn't been able to keep up with the waxing or anything like that. And so literally having my hair done was like the one thing that I was looking forward to the most. And so I got to have it done. And I knew that lots of people were going to come and see the baby because it was like the first child as well of the family. So I knew I was going to be in lots of photos. So having my hair done was like top priority. But with the first baby, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was young. I was 27. My friend had just had her baby. I was very much into like, you know, just kind of getting on with it. And I thought I had it. I thought I had it down. I thought I was like, I've got this. Second baby, oh, how so wrong. Because you forget that they come as they are and they're not going to be the same. So while I was spoilt with my first child and how good as gold she was in terms of just kind of getting on with life, drinking, breastfeeding, I breastfed her for 18 months. She walked at 9 months. She was just a great child. And then my second child, again, it was very traumatic pregnancy. I only could breastfeed her for 3 months. And then when I put her onto formula milk, she had an allergic reaction, had to call 999. Her face was swelling up. I thought, oh my gosh, like I'm killing my child. Like I was looking at her and I thought she looks really weird. And I looked at her hand and her hands had looked like she'd punched a wall. It was just all swollen. And I thought, oh, called 999. They came and they literally went straight to the hospital. And she was allergic to milk. And so for the next, 6 to 8 months, we had to really look at like all the different types of milk that she could have. She was on this nitro something, I can't remember what it's called now. But it was just, she was such a learning curve for me. Whereas my first child was just by the book. And so they come as they are. There's no one rule and there's no way to parent the same way that you did with one child. You always have to adapt to your parenting. And she does get away with a lot more than my first child does, just because I don't have the energy. And so,
I'm there.
Yeah, I don't have the energy. So whereas my first child is really, really obedient and like not that naughty, the second child really, she gets away with a lot. And because she's cute as well, so it's even worse.
Do you know what? I think it's worse in lockdown as well. Because I just think sometimes you're just like, no, don't do... Oh, go on then.
Yeah,
I can't.
Just do it.
I can't
just do
the arguments right now.
Yeah.
I'm fed up of hearing all the noise all the time.
Well, this is...
Go and have it.
This was one of the reasons why I didn't send my youngest one back to school. Because obviously she's in year one, so she could go back to school. But my oldest, who's in year four... They just haven't even talked about that year. They're like, they're going back in September. And the thought of doing the morning school run, having to wake her up but not wake the other one up, and that argument of, well, how come she's not going to school? And how come she gets to stay at home? I thought, that's not worth it for 4 weeks until summer holidays. It really, that argument is really not worth it in the morning. So kept them both home. Yeah, that was my reason.
I like it. Well, it's hard though, isn't it? Because it's another juggle. You're already juggling so much, then you've got to juggle all of that.
Yeah.
Plus, I think in a way, because I've kept mine off, and I think in a way we're helping the school because we're lowering the numbers in school and keeping it safer. So I think if you can, I think it works.
Yeah.
I would be the first one to send my daughter back. If she wasn't at her grandmother's, I would be sending her back to school.
If she was with you right now.
Yeah, she would be going to school tomorrow. ASAP. I've had enough. We always keep saying this. I think Natalie said it on our first lockdown pod, is that we didn't sign up to be mothers 24 hours a day to have the kids around us 24 hours a day.
We didn't choose this life. Corona chose us.
Yeah, we didn't Corona chose this life for us. We didn't choose this.
Although we have to give a disclaimer, because one of our Dope Black Mums, she has just had her fourth baby and she homeschools anyway, all of them.
She absolutely
loves
it.
She's just like this mother nature, barefoot, pregnant goddess, and we are all terrified of her.
I thought I would be that mum. I am not.
Nanadra absolutely loves it. Her four kids are under four or five.
She's
got four kids under five. And I'm like, she's like, homeschooling, it's, I absolutely love it. And I'm like, that's absolutely wonderful for you, Nanadra. Whatever Bible you are reading from, I may need to read that same one, because I will hold my hands up and be extremely honest. I cannot stand my daughter at the moment. And I think that's why I think she's fed up of me as well. She can't stand me anymore being like around us for like the last 3 months, three and a half, four months. It's just been her and I. And her great grandmother passed away a couple of weeks ago, and they had the funeral. So her grandmother was like, "Look, I really want the grandkids to come up, blah blah blah." And I was like, "Whoa! If you're happy for it, then yes, you can come. See ya, bye." She was meant to go for 2 days, and it's been 10 days and counting, and she hasn't come back. So I'm like, I'm getting to the point now where I'm kind of like, wow, I don't have anyone to shout at or anyone to say, like, why haven't you done your schoolwork?
There's still food in the fridge.
Yeah, there's still snacks. Like, I don't have to have a go at her for leaving the lights on in a room when she's not in there, or leave the TV on in a room when she's not in there. I don't have to hear five times a day, well, what do I need to do? I'm bored. Can we do something? I'm bored. I've been quite like, yeah, I'm at peace with it. So I don't know when she'll be home, but I'm quite enjoying this downtime.
Well, we know we've got a long stretch ahead of us because we've got at least until September. But I do think that next summer holidays, if we get there, they're going to feel so short. And homework after this is going to feel so easy.
Yeah, so true.
Without a doubt.
Honestly, I just don't know how anyone is getting any work done. I feel very lucky that I'm, you know, podcasting my thing. Baby club has been fine. Like, Tom's been home. But writing books, I've had to be like, nah, that can't happen. Because that's when you need your focus time. You need to be focused on that character. And there's just no way that I can do that when I've got a kid next to me asking me what 4 + 10 is. You know, I can't do that at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I think there's different types of focus, isn't there? Like, I definitely relate to the writing thing. There are some things you can kind of do with a child there and be kind of half in and half out, and there are some jobs or some parts of a job where you just need that focus and you have to really carve it out. It's a massive change, but it's good. We get to learn each other a bit more. Might be a few more divorces, but you know.
Well, China saw like a massive rate of divorces post lockdown. So it'd be interesting to see what the divorce rates are like once like lockdown is completely over here.
Yeah.
Because they did see a spike in their divorces after lockdown.
Oh, God. Something to look forward to.
Either that or marriage counsellors, the demand for marriage counsellors are going to go up.
Oh gosh. Obviously, and another massive thing has kind of hit at the end, or not at the, I keep thinking it's the end of coronavirus because something else has kind of overtaken it massively, is the death of George Floyd and this massive wave, I guess, that's happening in the Black Lives Matter movement is more apparent than ever how important it is. And it's a very strange time for everyone. How have you spoken about it to your children?
Well, I think for me, I try to avoid the conversation with my daughter quite a bit.
Really?
And then she walked in as the news was on and the news was showing the video of what happened. And she kind of froze and just stood there and watched it. And then afterwards walked out my room and then came back in and she was like, "Mum, why do police do that? Why is it that police officers in America don't like Black people?" And you know, we watch a lot of films together because she's 10. So she's much older than, you know, some of like Endy and Natalie's kids. She's older. So we watch a lot of older films. So like Freedom Writers, and there's another one with what's his name? Denzel Washington, where he takes a group of Black boys. This was at the time when integration was happening and then they were trying to get rid of white only schools and Black only schools and trying to get them to integrate. And it shows how like the two basketball teams had to come together and play together. And there was a lot of racism and tension between the Black boys and the white boys who played for the same team. And then it kind of showed how they overcame that and stuff. So she knows kind of the history of racism in the US and discrimination. And, you know, I think as a Black mother, I was always told from early, you have to work twice as hard as everyone else. And it's something that I've had to pass on to my daughter. She's very lucky because her school is very multicultural and very diverse. Her head teacher is a black Jamaican man. So she's lucky in that regard. But I understand and realise that she's in a very privileged position because not a lot of Black kids or kids of colour have that educational experience in primary school. And so for me, it has always been something that I can't shield her from racism. She's a Black girl. It's undoubtedly that she's going to experience it. And she did experience it when she was 5. And so I had to explain to her then at 5, kind of, you know, what this is about, what it is. And with the death of George Floyd, kind of, you know, explaining and reiterating to her the history of racism in America, how it manifests itself here, and making her aware of that and understanding the causes of that, the reasons for that, and what we're doing to try and dismantle those systems that perpetuate systematic racism. And, you know, I went to march last week. I hadn't been out the house really for the last 12, 13 weeks. And I'd been very adamant with her saying, you know, we've got to be careful. We only go out for walks or to the supermarket. And, you know, I explained to her, actually, yes, that's what I've been telling you, but this is a bigger issue at hand. And we have a responsibility and a moral obligation to try and effect change in the world. And if it means that we have to go out and do that and protest and march, then this is the reason for doing it. So I'm very open and honest with her, but I always have been. So I guess it's not something new for her, because we've always had those conversations. And, you know, my brother-in-law is white. My cousin is married to a white lady. My other cousin's married to an Asian lady. So we have a very diverse family. So to her, she doesn't understand that, because that's not what she sees within our friendship circles and our family environment. It's very diverse. So I think she does understand that it's not everybody. This is, you know, a part, some people in society, but actually she also understands the power of using your voice and having to speak out against something if there's something you're not happy about or something that's wrong.
Mm. I find it really difficult to navigate, actually, how much I tell him versus how much I protect him. What I don't want him to do is to see himself as separate to a system he lives within. I don't want him as a black boy to see him and the police as being two opposing things, him and authority. I don't want to kind of burden him with, you're going to be oppressed and you're going to, you know, experience X, Y, and Z. But like Karina was saying, you know, he is very privileged, doesn't he? He's got such a mix around him, literally, of all nationalities. His friendship group's really mixed as well. He hasn't heard of anything yet personally. He hasn't had any kind of experience of that. But, you know, obviously his dad is very, you know, is very kind of politically active as well, and is very open with conversations around race. So for me, it's trying to tread that line of giving him enough information so that he is prepared for the world that we live in, but also still allowing room for that hope that the world that he grows up into will potentially be a little bit more progressive than the world we grew up in. So I do find it difficult. I really do. And I really resent having to do that. I really hate that I have to do that to my son.
Because you just want your kids to be... Be kids and to have an innocence.
100%. And you know, for I know with my son, you know, it's like I give him organic food. He does guitar lessons, and he does, you know, you do all this investment to then go and kind of have to give them this cynicism of the world. But he's really cute. He's a really cute 9-year-old, but he won't be a cute 9-year-old forever. And so it's a challenge, and it's something that, you know, all of us as parents have to, I know this has brought out conversations around how to talk to, you know, we ask white parents to talk to their children about race, but it's still hard for us. It's not something easy.
It easy at all. In fact, I have had many parenting fails over the last 6 to 8 weeks, just trying to explain things to my children. You know, when we were in lockdown, I was trying to explain to my daughter about, you know, it's, you know, we're not allowed to go outside. I said, and she'd just been learning about like Anne Frank and World War II and all that kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, it's a bit like Anne Frank. She had to stay inside. She couldn't go outside. And then my daughter got a bit like, so what does that mean? Does that mean that someone's going to find us and snitch on us? And I'm like, okay, that was the wrong example. And then because my children are underneath my feet 24/7, they were asking me about periods and why do women bleed? And so I tried to explain again what a period was. And I was talking about that we have eggs inside our tummy. And so they were like, oh, so what? We're like birds. We're like chickens. And I was like, no, we've got eggs. And, you know, in order for the eggs to become a baby, you need a daddy to help. And they were like, well, how does the daddy help? And I thought, okay, I've mucked that one up as well. So these conversations, I know, are difficult. And with the race one, you know, we've had a few of those books. You know, there's a Rosa Parks books, there's different books that we've always had in our house. Again, I created a business, March Muses, based on creating diversity at Christmas time. And so they have seen Santa Claus that can be black, and they've seen a fairy that can be black. And so that was really our first conversation about different colour things, just because they thought angels were white and they didn't realise that angels could be any other colour until I created a brown angel for us to put on our Christmas tree. And so we started talking about race back then. But my youngest is six, and she does understand it, but I don't, again, want to burden her with too much. And so it's a learning process. And that's what I would say to parents listening now, if they want to navigate that conversation with their child and they don't know where to start, start with books, start with puzzles, start with toys that are different representations of what we live in, different colours, different, you know, puzzles that represent different things. Just start with that, and then it will authentically come about the different races and the different backgrounds of different people. No one's saying you have to sit down and say, right, today we're going to be talking about black people. And like, that to me is not how it should go. It should be authentic. So just start to introduce it into your life so it doesn't feel weird when they go outside in this world and they do see people of colour. It shouldn't feel weird to them.
And also having that, sorry, no, I was just going to...
No, go.
I think so much of it comes from should come from a place of empowerment rather than the world is awful and is out to get you. But actually, this is who you are and you're amazing and this is your history. And it's not just slavery, you know, your history is actually empires and it's inventors and it's a mix of wonderful things that exist outside of often what's taught in the curriculum. And also for any child, I think the more they can feel the importance of speaking their truth and not being nice, but being kind. And if you see someone who's not kind and is being, you know, is discriminating or not being nice to someone based on anything, then we must all speak up about it. And I think if it comes from a place like that, then that's more empowering than like teaching them about the awful things of the world that can just feel like a depressing rabbit hole that, you know.
And also sometimes they can just switch off if you go down that route. They'll just be like, okay, can I have a snack now? You know, they're just not even there because you've just gone somewhere that they can't get to.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
I think the most ridiculous thing, but the thing that did make me go, I don't know how I feel about that because of the way it was worded, was if you know that you've got an all-white group of friends, try and introduce some other, you know, ethnic groups into your... Like, what? If I was a black person and a white person started cracking onto me just so my kid could go to their party, I'd be like, what are you doing?
Exactly. And also, I'm very no new friends. Like that's my motto. Like my group of girlfriends are like my group of girlfriends. And as adults, it's hard to make new friends. It's hard to be like, oh, hi, do you want to be friends? And like to make real authentic friendships. And so I think that's really hard as well, just to be like, diversify your group now. It's like, that's impossible. So that's why I'm like, okay, let's just start with books, start with TV shows and maybe go to different areas of London or wherever you're from, like just so that you can actually enjoy the culture. Something that's amazing is obviously not happening this year, but Carnival. What an amazing event that is to actually just... And they have a Children's Day and you get to experience that culture in its all authenticity. And it's just amazing events like that, that you could just go to and just be a part of.
But I think
I didn't even know they did a Children's Day.
Yes, yeah. they have one on the Sunday, which is meant to be Children's Day, but it's just as busy as the Monday. But I think a lot, what happens with a lot of events and stuff that is quite heavily focused on black culture is that you get the negative attention to it or negative reports about what can happen there. And I think with Carnival, you know, I've been and I've taken my daughter and, you know, she has had a fantastic time. I think it was last year I went with you last year, didn't I, Natalie? So I think it was the year before I took her, and she absolutely enjoyed, like, loved it. And even like, there's so many different Independence Days throughout the year. So like Jamaica Independence is in August, so they normally will have massive like Jamaica Days in the parks and stuff. So like Crystal Palace Park normally has one, and I know one of the parks in North London normally have one, and they'll have like a jerk fest where they'll have everyone come out and, you know, they'll be cooking like jerk chicken and there's music and there's things for the kids. And even going to things like that and showing your kids like another culture and being able to experience food and, you know, activities and stuff, even small things like that can encourage kids to be more open-minded and more knowledgeable and aware of the world and the society that they're living in. And I think for me, Sunday dinner is a prime example of how I know that I'm Black British, but also I'm very, very, very aligned and in tune with the fact that I'm Jamaican. So very often, if you were to come to my house on a Sunday, there would be like curry goat or oxtail or like jerk chicken and then Yorkshire puddings and roast potatoes. And it's like, it's that mix of the fact that I am Jamaican, but I'm also British and I'm Black British, you know? So it's that mix. And so if you were to come to my house through the week, the differences of what you would get for dinner, you will see that it will either be like a British dish on Monday or it will be a Jamaican dish on another day. Or, you know, we'll get like an Indian takeout on like a takeaway or something like that on the weekends. And I think my daughter is very aware of the fact that, you know, we are Black, we are British, we are Jamaican, and everything that is encompasses that identity, we are in tune with. For her, I would love for her to be able to grow up and be comfortable in the fact that she is a Black woman when she's older and that she is existing in a society that accepts her for just being her. And what really annoys me, and we've spoken about on the pod, is when people say, I don't see colour. And for me, if you say that you don't see colour, that means that you don't see me. Because how can you look at me and not see colour? I'm a Black woman, and it's okay to say the word Black. It's okay to say, oh, that Black girl or that Black boy or that Black woman. Black's not...
See, that's the thing. So I was always brought up saying, why are you saying Black? What does the fact that she's Black say mean anything? Yeah. So, but that's, she's a Black woman, like, is now knowing that we're allowed to say
yes,
this.
It's
fine. And like Natalie has spoken about this where, you know, she'll be at work and someone will be like, oh, the girl over there, which girl? You know, the one with the red
brown
top
hair.
On. The one with the red, okay, there's five people with a red top on. The one with the, you know, and they're trying to say anything but the word Black. And it's like, it's okay to say, you know, the Black girl over there with the red top on. That's fine because it's identifying someone. And, you know,
and it's not racist to say the word Black.
Yeah, you can't look at someone and say that you don't see colour, because if you don't see colour, then you're not seeing me and everything that accompanies me as a Black woman or me as Karina.
And it also diminishes the fact that a lot of people, the world we live in, do see colour. So it's like someone saying, you know, I'm fighting for gender equality. And so, well, I don't see gender. There's no need to, you know, and there's no need to do that. Or there's no need to have a pride festival, you know, like the idea is that, you know, unfortunately.
Oh, that really made me chuckle when, on the podcast, when someone was saying about pride festival and about straight festival. Because, you know, you don't go to Pride, go, but where's my straight festival?
Yeah, exactly. You don't, like, you know, sort of petition Save the Whales and say you should save the tigers. You know, there is this weird thing. And I think it does come down to the fact we do feel uncomfortable when we're talking about race in a slightly different, more nuanced way than maybe when people talk about even gender or sexuality. There's, I actually think it's because in Britain and in the Western world, we've had a very painful history as Black and white people. And actually, that's the majority. Actually, that's not even, you know, people talk about it's not my ancestors and it's not. And absolutely right. It wasn't the majority of people's ancestors. It was really a few of the landed gentry that perpetuated this issue, which now we, I think, collectively have never really dealt with or spoken about. And there's this, and then I think it's just a hot potato and no one wants to have it. And therefore it doesn't really ever get resolved. And then we see things like, you know, the clashes on Sunday. Unfortunately, there is a lot of it out there still. So we must get through this and learn how to have these conversations. I think it's really important.
It just baffles me. And then, like I said, having those conversations with friends and then just having someone say, actually, when I went here, I felt very uncomfortable because I was aware of people looking at me. And you're just like, oh, how are we in the same room and not seeing the same thing? Because we're comfortable, because we're not there, you know. So I really hope that all these conversations that are happening, and I know you're not educators, you know, you're just sharing your experiences. And even then, I'm not allowed to ask, only if you're giving. How do you feel now knowing that and I guess in a sense, because you've written to white mums, that white mums will be listening to the podcast because it is a safe place for black women to share their experiences. And people like me will be coming in now and go, and just kind of, obviously, you're women, you're mums, and there's so much that I can relate to. And what's interesting, I think, if we're talking about race, being able to go, oh, like going to the Jamaican festival, whatever, going, listening to the podcast and going, oh, that's interesting, I haven't seen it like that before. So it's rather than kind of going into it and judging, because I don't believe in that at all. I think it's kind of going into it with eyes open and kind of going, ah.
It's an education, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's perfectly fine, because the same way if I want to learn about Pride, I might want to listen to a gay podcast just to get a bit more of an insight. Although I do have gay friends, I don't need to keep going up to them going, so you're gay, what does that mean? You're gay, so what do you need to do? We can have a conversation, that's fine, but I don't need to interrogate her about her gayness. I can look at that myself. So I think I love the fact that white mothers especially will come and listen to this podcast, our podcast, and educate themselves. And because we all know that women are superior. You know, we are the ones that make the world go round. And we have given birth to the future leaders of this country. We've given birth to the future government, the future politicians, the future, you know, we're giving birth to the future. So, you know, where it might not be in our lifetime that we see a big amount of change, hopefully in their lifetime, we'll see it because of all the education that we have instilled in them, because we have educated ourselves. So I'm more than happy for white parents to come and listen and educate themselves and learn some more. Absolutely.
I just find it fascinating. I think I'm 35 now, 35. That I'm learning so much that I know that you learn every day, but that there's this whole other thing that's going on that I was blind to. And I felt like I was aware. I think it's fascinating. The more you read, the more you listen to.
Because I know a lot of my white friends who are like some of my best friends, they felt really guilty. And they had...
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Guilt, like literally. Yeah, just absolute guilt, shame.
Yeah.
And just all of that. And then how do you manage that?
Because on top of mum guilt as well.
Yeah, and you can't talk to people about it because no one knows, and everyone's trying to work out where they are in their heads, and then you can't go and talk to your black friends about it because they're dealing with their own thing, and it's a very odd time to try and navigate your way through. And then at the same time, you've got to try and have the conversations with your kids because you want them to, you know, solve this as well and not be part of it, which, you know, I think it does feed down, doesn't it? And I think that is the scary thing about a Saturday and Sunday. It's kind of like, what are their kids picking up?
Exactly.
I don't know. It's so hard, isn't it?
And it's okay to feel guilty as well. I just think just educate yourself. You know, just read the books. There's so much now resources that have been pushed around in our WhatsApp group alone. Like literally resources. Even when we went into lockdown, all the homeschool resources that were being sent round, it was like there was just so much going on. And that's the same with this. There's a lot out there. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of stuff to educate yourself. But don't be scared to talk to your black friends. Don't interrogate them, but have that conversation. Just so it isn't draining. Definitely have that conversation, because if you're friends for a reason, the same way that I would talk to my friends about my ex-partner or about my droopy boobs or about my beard, is the same way that I'd want to have a fun, interesting, intellectual conversation about something that we are both affected by.
It's knowing how to approach something and how to address something. So for me, one of my longest white friends outside of school, Sam, I met her in nightclub toilets when I was like 18. And it was so funny how we met. Well, not funny, but it is funny. She's originally from Grimsby, and she moved down to London, and she was modelling and stuff down in London when we were like 18. So we were in the toilets. There was a massive queue for the toilet, and I got to the front and I went to use the toilet, and this girl barged past me and went into the toilet. So I said to her, excuse you. And she was like, yeah. And I was like, there's a queue, I'm next. And she was like, white people don't queue, you lot do. And then she called me the N-word. And, you know, I was 18. I was so taken aback. This was like a club in the West End in like Mayfair. I was so taken aback. And before I could even say anything, this girl swooped past me, punched her, and was like, "The toilet's free, babe." And I was like, okay.
Do you want to come in with me?
Yeah, I was like, okay. And everyone was like, everyone in the toilet was like, ooh. And the girl was just lying on the floor, and it was Sam.
And you've been best friends ever since.
Yeah, we've been friends since. Like, I used the toilet and I came out and she went, "Baby, you," she went, "do you know what? Come to my table." She was like, "I'm really sorry about that." She was like, I'm not going to let someone talk to you like that. And, you know, we've been friends ever since. And even like when she got married and I had to go up to Grimsby for her engagement party. So she's originally from Grimsby. So she'd moved back up there and lives like in a village outside Grimsby. So you still have to travel into Grimsby. And I remember going there and I was literally the only black in the village. And I stepped off the train and everyone just kept staring. And I was like, I feel so uncomfortable. And she messaged me a few weeks ago and she said, "I just want to know how you're feeling. Like, how are you feeling?" And I remember reading her message and I just burst into tears because I was like, I'm drained, I'm tired, and I'm really emotional at the moment. And again, I burst into tears over the weekend because she organised a Black Lives Matter march in Grimsby. And there's a really lovely picture of her like holding up a sign with her mask on. And you can even just see like the determination in her eyes. And I think for her, it's, you know, Lincolnshire is not the most diverse of places at all. Grimsby really isn't. So for her to, despite everything, put herself out there and say, actually, no, we need to understand our privilege. And I have got friends who this affects. And I may not be in London anymore, but I'm going to do this up north. And, you know, she galvanised, she got everyone out. And I think what she's been doing, she has she had a very, very successful modelling career before she moved back up to Grimsby. And she now, mentors a lot of young girls. And, she, you know, she said, "I want to be able to teach them and teach them about white privilege and teach them about, you know, we don't have a lot of diversity up here, but that doesn't mean that I can't create, you know, a group of girls and instill in them that actually diversity is a wonderful thing and, you know, how to be anti-racist and to identify your privilege and to use your voice." And, you know, that's what she's been doing. And I think, you know, just saying to me, "Karina, how are you?" She didn't need to go into anything else. She just simply wanted to know that I was okay. And I think a lot more people, it may be scary to, you know, approach your black friends and say to them, "How are you feeling? Let's have a conversation." But it's also equally scary for us sometimes existing in this society and in this environment. So, you know, we're all scared, but at the same time, we're all friends. So
and we're all trying to navigate it together. And I think that's what's so important about podcasts like these and podcasts like ours is that, although we live in London, we're very spoilt with diversity. And outside of London, there isn't, you know, some places aren't. And so it's this digital sisterhood that we are all creating right now with Happy Mum, Happy Baby and the Dope Black Mums podcast, where we are able to reach a whole range of audience and mums who, you know, wouldn't even know how to navigate this. And just we're able to kind of just bring them into this digital community. And I think that's what's so important about having moments like what we're having right now.
I also think that there's so much can be done in the small ways as well. It doesn't always have to be like what we put out on social media or in the world. Like, change starts at home. And, you know, how many times I know as a black woman, I've let things go when I've like heard someone say something a bit off and I've just thought, I can't like just kill the vibe and stand up and be like, "That's not funny." You know, I've done it myself. So I 100% know that many of our white counterparts will do that around the Christmas table. They'll do that sometimes at work, you know, because we're human beings and we don't want to cause a fuss. We don't want to be the, you know, the person.
And we're British as well.
And we're
definitely don't want to cause a fuss.
So we never like to say anything about anything. Exactly. So I think that those small changes we can make, because those are the changes, those things children pick up on. They pick up on if auntie says something that's a bit funny about that and no one says anything. Whereas if someone says, actually, auntie, that's racist, don't say that, the child will see that. And I think that we all can acknowledge that's hard. It's really not easy to do. But if we don't do that, you're just kind of leaving us and them. Whereas we need the middle portion, which I think, I hope, is the majority of the population who, of course, thinks that's abhorrent to behave like that, who would never call someone the N-word in a toilet, but equally hasn't really been active in looking at the society to see, well, where can we stop this? Because it does happen. And you know, we've been saying it's been happening forever. And so I think it's really important, those small conversations.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think for a long time, I know for me, I've just felt like I'm not racist. But actually, it's just realising that that's not enough, actually. And it is calling things out like that. And it is those simple, like, little things.
Yeah. And it's not easy. It really isn't. But I think we have to do it. And we have to make it, because it's almost gone somewhere. I think in today's climate, it's almost got to a stage where to call someone racist is worse than calling someone anything. Like, it's worse than the N-word or the P-word. It's called someone racist. People get incredibly angry about being called, I'm not racist, even alluding to that.
Listing all their black friends.
Yeah, I've got, exactly, I went to carnival and I've got, I eat this. And, yeah, exactly. So, and actually, it's that's taking us down the wrong route. You know, it's not about becoming so PC that we trip each other up and we can't even have a conversation. It's just about saying, okay, examining where some things come from, and then just doing the work, even if it's on ourselves. Like, why do I think this, and why do I not say anything if someone says that? And hopefully we'll just have a generation of braver kids that will be ready to call out stuff and stand up for things, you know, when they hear it.
And I guess part of it is, if that is being said by someone that you feel uncomfortable saying something to, if you are with your child, afterwards addressing that, you know, and saying, you know, he said that and that wasn't very, that what we don't say that, you know, it's just kind of explaining it in that way, because obviously we don't want people to put themselves in danger either. Like, that's a really...
And some conversations you'll have with family members, and you just know you're not going to change their mind. And you just know that that's just going to be their thought all the time. So sometimes it isn't worth the fight, but it's exactly what you said. It's talking to your child and going, how did you feel about what auntie said? Did you think that was okay? It's weird, isn't it? And just having that honest dialogue with them so that at least they know where you stand. And that is what true allyship is all about. We talk about our white allies, and that's exactly what we're talking about, is that you are using your voice where we can't. You're using your privilege where we can't. And I have so many white friends. I have so many white managers where I worked who are doing that. And that's what's been making me cry as well. Because I've just been like, thank you for listening, and thank you for speaking so I don't have to speak. That's what I want. And that's what we should all be adhering to and working towards. Mm.
So I wrote a letter, or a book of letters at the start of this year, that were a book of letters all about motherhood. So I literally wrote letters to my husband, my kids, my foof, my baps, all different body parts, my phone. So I was wondering, from each of you, if you could write a letter to anyone on motherhood, who would it be to and what would it say?
Ooh.
I think pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. Wow, I feel like I've got to say something really proud. I think maybe I would write a letter to myself, my own child. Within me, I'd write a letter to, like, maybe 6-year-old Endy, just because I've been thinking a lot about how, I think when you see things in your childhood, you're like, I definitely don't want to do that. I don't want to be like that kind of parent, but I do want that. You know, we look back and we think, oh, I wouldn't do it like that and do that. And sometimes, actually, even when we're trying not to recreate the same mistakes of our parents, we then swing in another direction and do something else. And actually, I think it's really important that we try as mothers, as parents, to resolve those issues and resolve those things within ourselves, so that we can parent from a place of neutrality, of authenticity, not from trying to either be like our parents or not be like them, and not from kind of, I don't know, carrying forth our own pain or our own issues or our own things and putting them onto our children. So I probably try and write a letter to myself to be like, little Endy, this is what you needed, this is what, you know, happened, and this is all wonderful, and try and kind of just show her some love so that I can maybe be a better parent. Oh. Everyone's like silent. Was that the wrong answer? I mean, fanny. I like the fanny one. I have a lot of respect. I have a great relationship with my vagina, so I equally could do that too. So
good.
I think I would write a letter to my hormones about motherhood and just how positive they have been sometimes and how negative they have been sometimes. Great hormonal moments where I'm just like elated and happy, and then also just down sometimes. But my biggest one, which I talk about a lot, is just the hair growth gene. It's like, why does it exist on my chin? Why does it exist in like just nonstop in every other area? I would talk about it. I just want to ask why. And it's lovely that it came through motherhood, because I didn't have this problem before motherhood. And I know it's hormones. I know it's, you know, I've had polycystic ovaries. I know it's a mixture of lots of things. But why? Why on my chin and not just on my head? That would be my
polycystic
question.
Ovaries. Yeah. I get a proper tash. Oh, like proper.
Listen, yeah. And then in lockdown,
catch
it's
me
like,
the wrong day of the week.
It's Ooh. Father Christmas. Like lockdown has been, it's been a real treat for my kids, and they've just been like, "What's this, mummy? Why is it all prickly here?" And I'm like, "Because you're here. That's why it's prickly. Because you're here." So yeah, motherhood letter to my hormones.
Nice. I like it, Karina.
I don't think mine would be as funny as Natalie and Indy's. I think I would probably write a joint letter to my mum and my daughter. And I think it would basically be saying how both of them saved me in their own way. So following my mum's death, I've spoken about this in like a work environment, and the fact that mental health within the Black community isn't spoken about very much. And there's a massive stigma against it. And you know, I was really depressed when my mum died, and to the point of, I think I woke up one day and I was like, right, I don't want to live anymore. And I was trying to take tablets and everything to try and, you know, kill myself. And I think that period kind of ended with me then having my daughter like 4 or 5 years later. And I think everything my mum had taught me in the 17 years of me having her in my life, of what it means to be a mum, I was able to apply that to being a mum to my daughter. And I say this all the time, that my daughter genuinely saved my life, because it was like a light bulb went off and it was like, right, okay, right, I've got this child here, I've got to live, I've got to find myself and be Karina again. And I think the Karina I am now is the Karina I was when I was, you know, 15, 16, 17. And I think, yeah, motherhood for me has been kind of me stumbling my way through it for the last 10 years. But everything that's underpinned each of those stumbling steps has been 17 years of my own childhood with my mum. So I think I would do a joint letter to both of them, because in their own way, they've saved me and brought back the Karina that I know.
Lovely. And we end the podcast with you finishing three sentences. So we're going to do, let's do Endy, then Karina, then Natalie, okay? So I'll start a sentence and let's just bosh this out. You're going to finish it, all right? Endy, being a mum means?
Being strong, empowered, being vulnerable, being open and accepting this amazing journey.
Lovely. Being a mum means, Karina.
Being a mum means not having my life together on a Monday morning when school uniforms should be ironed, washed and ready to go. Being a mother means drying it on the dryer in the car on the way to school. And yeah, being a mother means you're never going to get it right, and that's okay.
Love it. Yeah, Natalie, so being a mum means?
Being a mum means a beard, a tash.
time.
It means tiredness. It means stress. But my God, it means the most amazing, wonderful love that you will ever experience. And just how proud I am to be called a mum.
Amazing. Right. Second sentence, Endy, it is, since having a child, I
have a slightly different shaped vagina. actually have saggy boobs that were saggy before anyway, but now I have a really great excuse for them to be saggy. So I'm really proud of that. And I'm more softer, like, you know, you see things on the news and you just cry, and, you know, and just more scared, because a heartbeat that was in you is now out in the world. So a little bit softer, a little bit more vulnerable. That's what's changed.
I've never heard it described like that before. You almost got me there. You almost had me. Okay, Karina, since having a child, I
have not been able to use the bathroom or do a poo in peace.
Very true. Natalie, since having children, I
haven't had a hot cup of tea, and my washing machine is literally my second best friend.
Nice. And finally, I'm happy when, Endy.
I'm happy when I am with the people that I love, and when I'm doing what I love, and when I'm feel like I'm in flow with life, I guess.
Nice. Karina, I'm happy when?
I have an alcoholic beverage in my hand. Endy called it.
I knew it was coming.
And you know exactly what drink it will be as well.
I know it's the Ray Nephews. I could just, yeah. I don't know why I'm coming out with all this deep stuff today. I'm like probably Oprah vibe today.
I'm surprised, Endy, because normally me and you are like, you know, alcohol.
I know. Today, I've just, yeah.
Yeah, I'm at my happiest when I have alcohol.
Natalie, I'm happy when?
I'm happy when this pandemic will be over and we can go back to some sort of normality of seeing my friends, of taking my kids out and just enjoying and navigating this crazy thing that we call life.
Amazing. Ladies, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you for having us. It's been so
lovely being here. You are a dope white mum.
Yay! So, yes.
We absolutely adore you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I've laughed so much. Thank you. Lockdown isn't that bad when I get to sit up here and do this. So thank you so very, very much.